war is not my first choice. Don't get, you know, it's my last choice, but nevertheless, it is an option in order to make the world a more peaceful place.
People cannot find the medicine, even the milk for their children. Think about the 10 years, more than 10 years. Now they cannot buy anything.
It's interesting, in the Saddam Museum in Baghdad, you can see a pair of golden cowboy spurs that Ronald Reagan gave Saddam Hussein.
I think today the mainstream American media is to the United States what Pravda and TASS were to the Soviet Union. They have become the mouthpieces of the government.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, December 30th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. As the Bush administration advances its agenda towards war with Iraq, North Korea has declared that it has begun removing UN surveillance equipment at a Yongbyon nuclear plant. Peter Brooks, the former Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary, says despite the fact that both North Korea and Iraq have an expansionist record, the U.S. should concentrate on diplomatic options.
North Korea invaded South Korea. Saddam invaded Kuwait. So I don't see that one is not expansionist and the other is. And the administration said we have to go after Saddam because he doesn't treat his people well. Well, North Korea doesn't treat their people well either. Saddam, by the administration's own admission, is at least 3 and maybe 7 years away from getting a nuclear weapons. And the fact of the matter is Saddam can be contained as well as North Korea. I think the administration should be talking to them. But the fact that they're pursuing a diplomatic way to deal with it is the correct thing, and this is exactly what we should be doing in Iraq. I have no doubt we can fight the two wars, but it's not necessary because these are not wars of survival. These are wars of choice.
Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary Peter Brooks. Bush administration officials said yesterday the United States plans to secure Iraqi oil fields if it invades and is looking into the possibility of ramping up oil production beyond the UN Oil for Food program to pay for post-war reconstruction. Secretary of State Colin Powell said the oil fields are the property of the Iraqi people, and if the coalition of forces goes into those oil fields, we would want to protect those fields and make sure they're used to benefit the people of Iraq and are not destroyed or damaged by the failing regime on the way out the door, he said. Revenue generated from the oil fields would be used in accordance with international law and to benefit the people of Iraq. Increasing Iraqi oil production may help Western oil-consuming nations, including the U.S., by lowering oil prices, but it could hurt key U.S. oil-producing allies such as Saudi Arabia and Russia by reducing their revenues from oil sales. Iraq sits on top of the world's second-largest oil reserves, but war and a decade of sanctions has withered its oil infrastructure and official exports. Analysts have said international oil companies like Exxon, Mobil, BP, and Shell would want to take part in any rehabilitation of the country's oil industry. On another front, U.S. defense officials disclosed yesterday that Saudi Arabia would let the U.S. use its air bases and an important operations center in a possible war with Iraq. The unidentified officials say American aircraft using the bases would likely be for defensive purposes only, with ground attack jets striking Iraq from elsewhere in the region. But a high-tech operations center at Prince Sultan Air Base could be used to coordinate airstrikes against Iraq. Secretary of State Colin Powell declined to confirm the Saudis had agreed to allow the U.S. to use air bases and the command center in their country, but said, quote, we are in consultation with the Saudi Arabians on all of these issues. On CBS Face the Nation, Powell added, I'm not unhappy with the level of cooperation we've received from the Saudis on all aspects of the global war on terrorism and what we're doing with respect to Iraq. Today's Washington Post features a front-page article titled, U.S. Had Key Role in Iraq Buildup. The piece outlines U.S. support for Iraq during the 1980s, including meetings Donald Rumsfeld had with Saddam Hussein and other Iraqi officials. Jeremy Scahill, a producer for Democracy Now!, broke the story of these meetings and their political context in August of this year in an article titled, The Saddam in Rumsfeld's Closet. We bring you now an excerpt of an interview last August with Jeremy Scahill and Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman.
So talk about what you have found in your research. What do you mean the Saddam in Rumsfeld's closet?
Well, first of all, everyone who watches TV or reads the newspapers knows that Donald Rumsfeld is one of the top people in the administration making accusations that Saddam Hussein's government has chemical weapons and is prepared to use them, though he hasn't brought any evidence to the American people to prove this as a fact. So I was researching Donald Rumsfeld's connection to Iraq and found that 5 years before Saddam Hussein's now notorious gassing of the Kurds in 1988, it's the number one talked about incident when people refer to Iraq's threat to international security and to the region, a key meeting took place in Baghdad that would end up playing a significant role in ties between Saddam Hussein and Washington. And it came at a time when Saddam Hussein was first alleged to have used chemical weapons. The U.S. State Department was alleging that they had evidence that Saddam Hussein had used and possessed chemical weapons. The United Nations came out with a report that said that a team on the ground in Iran had evidence that the Iranian soldiers had chemical weapons used against them. So just to set the context, in the early 1980s, 1982 was the time when Saddam was first alleged to have really built up any kind of chemical weapons structure. Well, with the Iran-Iraq war escalating, President Ronald Reagan dispatched his special envoy to the Middle East on a tour of nations in the region. And one of the places that he sent his envoy was to Baghdad. His envoy was a former Secretary of Defense and a veteran diplomat. And he sent this diplomat with a personal letter, a handwritten letter to Saddam Hussein, and a message that Washington wanted to talk, that Washington wanted to normalize relations with Iraq. They'd been severed since 1967 with the Arab-Israeli War, and the Reagan administration was looking at the rise of the Islamic fundamentalist government in Iran, and they saw Saddam Hussein's government as a secular opposition to that. So the person who delivered that handwritten letter from Ronald Reagan to Saddam Hussein was Donald Rumsfeld, the current U.S. Defense Secretary. Rumsfeld visited Iraq on December 19th and 20th of 1983. His visit to Baghdad made him the highest-ranking official in 6 years to visit Iraq. And he was there with the mission to restore diplomatic relations between the two countries and deliver this handwritten letter. He met Saddam, and the two discussed what the Iraqi Foreign Ministry called at the time topics of mutual interest. And what's interesting is I found an interview with Donald Rumsfeld several years later in which he was asked about that meeting, and this was before the United States was so-called at war with Iraq. And he said Saddam made it clear that Iraq was not interested in making mischief in the world, he told the New York Times. And then he went on to say, it struck us as useful to have a relationship given that we were interested in solving the Mideast problems.
Hmm. So that was his first visit to Iraq. What happened with Rumsfeld after that?
Well, 12 days after that meeting, on January 1st, 1984, just to show you the connection here, the Washington Post reported, January 1st, 1984, that the United States, in a shift in policy, has informed friendly Persian Gulf nations that the defeat of Iraq in the three-year-old war with Iran would be, quote, contrary to U.S. interests, and has made several moves to prevent that result. That's 12 days after Donald Rumsfeld met with Saddam Hussein. It's interesting, in the Saddam Museum in Baghdad, you can see a pair of golden cowboy spurs that Ronald Reagan gave Saddam Hussein.
So when did Donald Rumsfeld leave as the envoy for Reagan?
He resigned in 1984, but prior to that, he returned to Iraq in March of 1984, and the Iran-Iraq war was growing more and more brutal by the day, and Rumsfeld was back in Iraq, in Baghdad, for meetings with the then Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz, and on the day of his visit, on March 24th, news agencies around the world reported that mustard gas laced with a nerve agent has been used on Iranian soldiers in the 43-month Persian Gulf War between Iran and Iraq. And this came from an on-the-ground team of United Nations weapons inspectors. This happens while Donald Rumsfeld is in Iraq. Prior to that, though, on March 5th of 1984, the U.S. State Department had issued a statement that said that they have available evidence indicating that Iraq has used lethal chemical weapons. Donald Rumsfeld is the most senior official to visit Iraq in 6 years. He's in Iraq on the day that the United Nations issues a report saying that Iranian soldiers have had chemical weapons used against them. He is in Iraq armed with a State Department statement from several weeks ago saying that the State Department has available evidence that Iraq has used chemical weapons. And Donald Rumsfeld, the man on TV all the time now, talking about the threat of chemical weapons that Saddam Hussein poses, said nothing. He said nothing in Iraq when the alleged threat to international security first emerged.
in fact, then relations were restored with Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, officially, relations were restored just after Donald Rumsfeld resigned. So it's almost as though he came in, he did his job, and he left, and then he went back into the private sector. And, of course, it's been well documented, though it's not often talked about, that many U.S. companies were involved with selling Iraq components that were used then to make allegedly chemical weapons. And the Reagan administration, in 1982, took Iraq off of its list of states that sponsor terrorism, and that opened the floodgate of trade. In fact, the White House was encouraging weapons manufacturers and other companies to trade with Iraq to boost the American economy. It's an extraordinary story of how U.S. corporations aided Iraq in its buildup of its weapons
and
capacity.
The same group of people who were in power then, because it's not only, of course, President Reagan, it was Vice President Bush, and then Rumsfeld, the envoy, are back in power now. You have the U.S. Senate responding, sweeping sanctions unanimously passed by the U.S. Senate that would have denied Iraq access to most U.S. technology. How did the Reagan-Bush administration respond?
They killed it, plain and simple. If you have to back up a little bit, this was in 1988 when Saddam allegedly gassed the Kurds at Halabja. But prior to that, under the Reagan administration, in 1984, according to the LA Times, the State Department, in the name of, quote, increased American penetration of the extremely competitive civilian aircraft market, pushed through the sale of 45 Bell helicopters to Iraq. These helicopters were worth some $200 million, and they were originally designed for military purposes. So this is a man who's alleged to have used chemical weapons. The U.S. says they have available evidence to indicate that. And then the Reagan administration is approving contracts against the objections of several members of Congress of military capacity helicopters. Later in 1991, intelligence officials told the Los Angeles Times that they believe that the American-built helicopters were among those dropping the chemical weapons on the Kurds in 1988. And so the Senate attempted to impose sanctions on Iraq, and the White House killed the measure.
Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill speaking with Amy Goodman about his article entitled The Saddam in Rumsfeld's Closet, published last August. The second annual convention of the Muslim Public Affairs Council was recently held in Long Beach, California. The council is comprised of experts in Islamic affairs and included a panel discussion of the impending war in Iraq. Dr. Mugdara Khan, Assistant Professor of Political Science, Director of International Studies, and Chair of the Department of Political Science at Adrian College in Michigan, spoke with KPFK correspondent Armando Gudina regarding the role of media in legitimizing a war on Iraq.
What role has American mainstream media played in legitimizing a war against Iraq?
Well, I think the mainstream media has not done enough to challenge the administration on its logic. For example, they had two arguments. You know, one argument was that Saddam Hussein was somehow connected with September 11th, which is quite obviously untrue. The second one is this whole logic that if he possesses nuclear weapons or chemical weapons, then he will give it to terrorists who will then use it against us or our enemies. Now, we know that Saddam Hussein has had chemical weapons for over 20 years. He used them in the Iran-Iraq war. He used them against the Kurds. But he never gave it to anybody. He could have given it to Hezbollah, who could have used it against Israel. He could have given it to Al-Qaeda, who could have used it on September 11th. So the logic that if he has chemical and weapons of mass destruction, he will use it via terrorism is untrue. So the question then begins to understand that why do we need to go into Iraq? And these are some very serious questions. What is the grand strategy behind Iraq? And those are the serious questions which the media has not asked. And if you look at the latest coverage by CNN, I think CNN is surrendered, and that they're more talking about how they're going to cover the war rather than discussing whether we should go to war or not. And the change in the CNN for the last week is because I suspect that at CNN, it is the viewership of Fox which determines their editorial policy, not the content of the reporting. And I think that's one of the saddest things. The day news reporters start sort of advertising their patriotism, the day people start wearing the flag on the lapel, I mean, I think today the mainstream American media is to the United States what Pravda and TASS were to the Soviet Union. They have become the mouthpieces of the government. And that tells you that the democracy has already been compromised. Democracy works when the media and the government are antagonistic.
The political socialization of the masses, how can we as independent media or other progressive venues combat what has been a very successful campaign on the part of the Bush administration and mainstream media? How do we deal with this issue?
See, one of the problems with progressive media is that they are, shall we say, preaching to the choir all the time. We have a constituency. There is a constituency for these peace movements. There's a constituency for that. What has happened is that they are not expanding. And see, the only media which has really grown is Fox since September 11th. And that tells you which way the country's mood is going. And so the progressive media has to find some way of competing with the mainstream media on mainstream issues. And I don't know how. I can't suggest. I mean, if I knew that, probably I would be running my own media. But it is. That's one thing that the progressive media has to do, is to find out a way. Plus, what has happened is that the whole world is becoming rightist. It's moving towards the right. I just wrote a piece called "The World Is Turning Right." It's not only in Turkey that the Islamists have come to power, in Pakistan, in most of the European countries, and the United States. The conservatives have taken everything. They've taken the Senate, the Congress, and blah. So what is happening is when the mainstream is turning towards the right, the media is going to become ghettoized politically, the progressive and challenging media. And I think the only way that the media can create is become more aggressively activistic, and to have more streets, more protests in the street. But there is still a big ally that the media has, and that is the academy. The university is the only place today in America where still serious questions are asked. And if you notice, the emergence of groups like Campus Watch, for example, are trying to curtail freedom of speech. Lynn Cheney came up with a website where they were trying to attack professors who were critical of American foreign policy. So they're even attacking the academia. And somehow I think that progressive media should combine with the academia and at least make a fight of it.
You alluded to this earlier, and I'll ask you again. If and when... the Bush administration goes to war with Iraq, what's next afterwards? Or I should say, who's next?
Well, it depends on how quick the war ends. Okay, and it's not like I said this when they were going to Afghanistan. This is not like an NBA season, like you put it on schedule that then Saturday we play Washington Wizards and Tuesday we're going to Lakers. But it depends on what happens in Iraq. If they can fulfill the objective of occupying quickly with minimal casualties, then they will be emboldened to such an extent that Iran is obvious. What they might do is, see, what has happened is that they have strategically encircled Iran anyway. They have troops in Uzbekistan and Afghanistan. They have troops in the north. They have troops in the south of Iran. The only place they don't have troops is on the west of Iran. And with troops in Iraq, they would have strategically encircled Iran. They can put enough pressure from just maintaining troops out there and having ratcheting up rhetoric and sanctions to genuinely try to get a regime change in Iran. And Iranians will not do that. The conservatives will become more stronger, and there's going to be a fight.
I think they would like to see
a long-term occupation of this whole area.
And what will be the role of Saudi Arabia in this before and after?
The Saudis are being very stupid about it. If they let the Americans take Iraq, they will support them to take with Iran, and then they will be next. And I think the Saudis are not going to see this until the tanks start rolling into Riyadh.
Dr. Mukduda Khan, Assistant Professor of Political Science, Director of International Studies, and Chair of the Department of Political Science at Adrian College in Michigan, speaking with KPFK correspondent Armando Godinha.
Listen up, yeah. Went down by the river where the cold wind blowing.
Wind blowing.
Up jumped a fish about 100 years old. I said, fish. Whoa, Mr. Fish. I said, fish. Mr. Fish. He said, yes. What can I do for you? Yes, sir. What can I do for you? I said, my world in trouble. Give me some advice.
Tell me something good.
Evil destruction. And you know that ain't nice.
armies are gathering in the Middle East. Everybody fidgety. They got that pre-war disease. They got the media talking stuff. The major world powers are joining up, surrounding a nation who control the crude. You know, the thing is black and sticky. What are we gonna do?
What we gonna do? The pre-nuclear war blues, a message to the world from Mandrill. In a recent speech at Boston University, author William Rivers Pitt revealed shocking details chronicling the step-by-step development of the other American dream. Pitt told how the U.S. has manipulated foreign policy to ensure America's control of natural resources in the Middle East and Asia. In their book, War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know, Pitt and former U.N. weapons inspector Scott Ritter dismantle the myths surrounding Iraq's present weapons capability, and they uncover the neoconservative forces behind the White House's push for war on Iraq.
There is another American dream, which lurks in shadow and speaks only in whispers of its designs. It works at all hours of the day and night to achieve its goals. It does not sleep. The existence of this other American dream places the first one, the real one, the true one, in terrible peril. If this other American dream is allowed to blossom into its intended potential, the American dream we speak of to our children will cease completely to exist. The proponents of this other American dream look at the world in terms of empire. They seek to achieve hegemony over great swaths of strategically important territory and will do whatever is necessary to gain this control. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, they see America as the first truly global superpower. With the use of economic and military might, they seek to gain absolute dominion in the space opened by the fall of our former rival. The term globalization encapsulates only a fraction of this idea. For many years, the proponents of this other American dream lingered in neoconservative think tanks like the Committee on the Present Danger, where they could only snipe from the fringes. With the rise to power of George W. Bush in an election that denied him even the pretense of a mandate, these neoconservative strategists suddenly found themselves walking the halls of power, because Bush was forced in the absence of that mandate to fall back upon his neoconservative base for support. The other American dream, alive for so long only in white papers within these think tanks, has become the central framework of American policy. One proponent of this strategy is Richard Perle, a former Defense Department official within the Reagan administration. Perle is now chairman of the powerful Defense Policy Board, which carries great weight within the Pentagon. Recently, this board listened with avid attention to a policy briefing proffered by another hard-right think tank from the RAND Corporation that proposed a, quote, grand strategy for the Middle East. The final slide of their presentation offered, quote, Iraq as the tactical pivot, Saudi Arabia as the strategic pivot, and Egypt as the prize, in an effort to extend American hegemony over the entire Middle East. Such plans cast into deep shade the reasons put forth by the Bush administration to defend war on Iraq. There is more on the table here than threats of weapons of mass destruction. The framework for this other American dream has other champions in positions of great influence within the Bush administration. Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld and his assistant Paul Wolfowitz spring from the same neoconservative think tank roots as Richard Perle. From their places high in government, these fringe elements have gained the required position to push forward with their plans. This other American dream is not solely a creation of the Bush administration, nor has it just recently come to fruition, nor is it fixated solely upon the Middle East. The bloody history of Afghanistan represents a clear example of the kind of geopolitical gamesmanship that characterizes the plans these people have for America. Afghanistan in 1978 was ruled by a communist puppet regime called the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, the PDPA. To foster a destabilization of that regime so as to counter the growing Soviet influence in that strategically vital region, America began arming and training Afghan Mujahideen warriors with Pakistan's assistance in an effort to undermine the PDPA. This effort, however, had more in mind than the overthrow of the PDPA. Eli Krakowski, in a study written for the Institute for Advanced Strategic and Political Studies in April of 2000, described Afghanistan's importance as going far beyond the dictates of the Cold War. Quote, Afghanistan owes its importance to the location at the confluence of major routes. A boundary between land power and sea power, it is the meeting point between opposing forces larger than itself. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, it has become an important potential opening to the sea for the landlocked new states of Central Asia. The presence of large oil and gas deposits in that area has attracted countries and multinational corporations. Because Afghanistan is a major strategic pivot, what happens there affects the world. Unquote. This places America's aid to the Mujahideen in 1978 in a broader perspective. Our actions were not simply about attacking communism. In attempting to destabilize the PDPA, we were hoping to tempt the wrath of the Soviet Union. It worked. The Soviet Union invaded and eventually destroyed its ability to extend influence into the region against the unyielding rock of Afghanistan, eliminating a strategic enemy and opening the region to broadening American control. Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor for President Carter during this period, bluntly confirmed this in 1998. Quote, "We did not push the Russians into invading, but we knowingly increased the probability that they would. The secret operation was an excellent idea. The effect was to draw the Russians into the Afghan trap." Brzezinski's brag is revelatory, for it describes the lengths to which the proponents of this other American dream will go to achieve this goal. Afghanistan was utterly destroyed by the Soviet invasion in 1979, by the 10-year war fought by Afghan warriors to remove them, and by the ravaging civil war that descended in the aftermath of the Soviet withdrawal. In that span was born the Taliban, trained to fight and to propound their deadly interpretation of Islam in Pakistani religious schools funded and supported by the American CIA. Brzezinski's Afghan trap gave birth as well to Osama bin Laden, whose reputation as a heroic anti-Soviet Mujahideen warrior made him a demigod within Afghanistan. None of this, the Soviet invasion, the Taliban, Osama bin Laden, the wretchedness of life in Afghanistan, would have come into existence without the forces behind the other American dream playing out these geopolitical strategies that do not consider the after effects of their actions. This other American dream was codified by Brzezinski in 1998, who authored in that year a study for the Council on Foreign Relations entitled The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives. The study described in detail the importance of Afghanistan and the entire Central Asian region, which is described in this report as Eurasia. According to the study, America must gain military and economic control of the region to stave off competition from China, Russia, and Europe. And I quote now the guts of that study. Quote, "But the Eurasian Balkans are infinitely more important as a potential economic prize. An enormous concentration of natural gas and oil reserves is located in the region, in addition to important minerals including gold. It is imperative that no Eurasian challenger emerges capable of dominating Eurasia and thus also of challenging America. A power that dominates Eurasia would control two of the world's three most advanced and economically productive regions. To put it in terminology that harkens back to the more brutal age of ancient empires, the three grand imperatives of imperial geostrategy are to prevent collusion and maintain security dependence among the vassals, to keep tributaries pliant and protected, and to keep the barbarians from coming together." Profoundly disquieting are the conclusions reached by Brzezinski regarding the means by which the American populace could be directed into supporting the actions required to achieve control in that region. Quote, "As America becomes an increasingly multicultural society, it may find it more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues except in the circumstance of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat." The danger is clear. The geopolitical strategy of dominion in Central Asia, begun in 1978 with the Afghan trap, put in motion a series of events that ultimately led to the creation of the Taliban, the empowerment of Osama bin Laden, and the attacks of September 11th. The plans described to Richard Perle's Defense Policy Board that target not only Iraq, but Iran, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and indeed the entire Middle East were born from these same strategic imperatives. This is the other American dream. Because of the terrorism we have already endured, many of our essential liberties have been taken away in the blasphemous guise of protecting freedom. They continue their work right now, at this moment. Nothing they are doing has your best interest, safety, or security in mind.
Williams Rivers Pitt, author of War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know. Thanks to Mark Weaver of community station WMBR in Boston for that report. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be right back.